ABC News, World News This Week. I'm John Grimes, ABC News. Listen.
I will request and fight for a $270 million package.
We are a peace-loving country, but we have our pride.
The helicopter crews fired in self-defense.
Judge Bork is wrong on civil rights.
To Bork, meaning to destroy by innuendo.
The tactics and techniques of national political campaigns have been unleashed on the process of confirming judges.
In a moment, the people and stories that made this week's World News.
Just a drink or two can affect your driving. This man knows.
I learned it the hard way. I pulled out of this parking lot right in front of a guy. And the thing is, I saw him. I saw him coming. But I could have sworn he was a lot further away. I knew as soon as he hit me that it was my fault. I also knew I wasn't drunk. I only had two drinks. Normally, I wouldn't have had them, but I met a friend. We stopped off. I bought him one. He bought me one. And that was it. It just happened. You want to hear the best part? I'm dead set against drunk drivers, and here I caused a wreck because of two lousy drinks. It's really humiliating for a guy like me to have to go up in front of a judge on a thing like this. I don't even think of taking a drink from one week to the next. I've got three kids, and I think of how lucky I was that I didn't kill myself or somebody else. I'll guarantee you one thing, there isn't going to be a next time.
Even a little drinking can dull your judgment. Think about it. A public service from the Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association.
When judicial nominees are assessed and treated like political candidates, the effect will be to chill the climate in which judicial deliberations take place, to erode public confidence in the impartiality of courts, and to endanger the independence of the judiciary.
Judge Robert Bork ended the speculation himself Friday afternoon after a meeting with President Reagan. He will carry on to the bitter end. That is, a full Senate vote on his nomination to the Supreme Court, a vote that will almost certainly lead to his defeat. ABC's Bob Clark has some numbers.
The on-the-record count of senators who've announced they'll vote against Judge Bork now stands in the 50s. Some Democrats who would have preferred not to say how they would vote were coaxed into the open by anti-Bork forces eager to seal their victory. Hardline conservatives, meanwhile, are pressing to keep Bork's name in nomination, hoping his rejection by the Senate would work to the advantage of Republicans in next year's elections.
Bork's nomination to the High Court was in trouble almost from the start of the Senate judiciary hearings, but the committee vote 9-5 against his confirmation was a big blow to Bork's supporters. Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy was among the staunchest of Bork's opponents.
Judge Bork is wrong on civil rights, wrong on equal rights for women, wrong on the right to privacy, wrong on freedom of speech. And President Reagan is wrong to try to put him on the Supreme Court.
But Arizona Democrat Dennis DeConcini had been considered a possible swing vote.
I have two daughters. One's a lawyer, one's a doctor, almost a lawyer. If they were truck drivers or heavy machinery operators, I would want someone on the Supreme Court who felt that the Equal Protection Clause applied to them.
So had Alabama's Howell Heflin, a former Chief Justice of his state's Supreme Court. His negative vote came after two personal conversations with President Reagan.
A lifetime position on the Supreme Court is too important to risk to a person who has continued to exhibit and may still possess a proclivity for extremism in spite of confirmation protestations.
Pennsylvania's Republican Arlen Specter also voted against the Bork nomination. South Carolina's Strom Thurmond sounded angry about the outcome.
In my 33 years, I have never seen the assaults made by different groups on anyone like to have on this man.
And Wyoming's Republican Alan Simpson vowed to continue the fight.
Emotion, fear, guilt, and racism swung the day. And emotion will always triumph over fact or reason, but reason will always persist, and we'll get to tell our story one more time.
Earlier in the week, President Reagan was asked about the possibility of a negative judiciary vote.
Mr. President, looks like the Bork nomination will fail in the committee. over my dead body.
And indeed, in spite of the committee defeat, the prospect of defeat on the Senate floor made the debate even hotter. This is Oregon Republican Mark Hatfield.
We have watched the political extremes, the fear warriors and the hate warriors of the left and of the right, each side reinforcing the extremism of the other in a hate concerto.
New Mexico's Pete Domenici said Bork's opponents had tried to destroy the nominee's reputation.
Judge Bork has been painted as a constitutional Neanderthal. His opponents have defamed his wife. They rummaged through the records of videotape rentals. I've even received one letter complaining about his alleged drinking problems.
And Domenici added the proceedings could be used to introduce a new verb into the English language.
To bork, meaning to destroy by innuendo or distortion.
The president devoted his weekly radio address to the Bork nomination for the second week in a row.
I knew that any decision made by Judge Bork would be made on solid grounds of principle, in contrast to those who would politicize our courts, jeopardize the independence of the judiciary, and hold our courts and Constitution hostage.
So did the Democrats. Senator George Mitchell of Maine spoke for his party.
Instead of proposing the conservative view that government's powers are limited, Judge Bork's view expands government power to the maximum and limits individual rights to the minimum.
But it may be that Nebraska's James Exon put it best when he took to the Senate floor to ask that the Bork nomination be withdrawn.
All the king's horses and all the king's men can't put Judge Bork's nomination back together again.
The full Senate debate on the Bork nomination could start late next week. U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf came under hostile fire this week. Navy Seabat assault helicopters shooting it out with Iranian patrol boats. Pentagon spokesman Fred Hoffman says the U.S. action was clearly within the rules of engagement.
The firing on the U.S. helicopter was clearly a hostile act. The helicopter crews fired in self-defense.
ABC's Bob Zelnick has details.
According to the Pentagon, U.S. choppers were on routine patrol about 25 miles southwest of the island of Farsi when one of them came under fire from four Iranian patrol boats. It radioed for assistance. It was joined by other assault helicopters. They fired machine guns at the patrol boats. Within the space of about a minute, they sunk three of them. A fourth one got away.
Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger talked about the incident Friday morning.
There were six Iranian casualties. They were taken out of the water by our rescue crews and transferred to one of our ships. Two have died, and the other four are awaiting reports on their medical condition before they can be transferred.
The Pentagon adds that the Iranian patrol boats may have panicked when they heard the helicopters approaching and began firing without knowing they were shooting at Americans. The entire episode took less than a minute, but as far as Congress was concerned, it was a fateful minute. A minute which added to the continuing and growing cry for President Reagan to invoke the War Powers Act in the Persian Gulf. But as Sheila Cast reports, the president isn't very anxious to comply.
As they have after other shooting incidents in the Gulf, White House officials say they're reviewing whether to invoke the War Powers Act. The act requires a report to Congress in case of imminent hostilities and would require U.S. troops to come home in 90 days unless Congress votes to keep them in the Gulf. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater insisted yesterday's incident was isolated and said the president is in compliance with the law. But Fitzwater also said the White House considers parts of the law unconstitutional because they tie the president's hands. And he said the White House might challenge it in court. Sheila Cast, ABC News, the White House.
On the Senate floor, where the War Powers Act was the subject of the day, Arizona Republican John McClain, arguing against invoking the act, said it would just cause more trouble. He quoted General Maxwell Taylor, "For if the trumpet gives an uncertain sound, who shall prepare for battle?"
We are sounding an uncertain trumpet by attempting to tie the hands of the President of the United States and to, in my opinion, in an unfortunate and dangerous way, legislate our withdrawal from the Persian Gulf.
Connecticut Republican Lowell Weicker had the other side of the discussion.
I don't care whether it's the laying of mines,
whether it's shooting missiles at our helicopters, whether it's missiles that go ahead and damage our ships and kill and maim our personnel. Clearly, all these things have transpired. And all these things, by any definition, are hostilities, and hostilities triggers the law of the land.
The Persian Gulf was the basis for a debate in the House, too. California Democrat Mel Levine got right to the heart of the problem.
Iran has become the second largest supplier of crude oil to the United States. Mr. Speaker, that quite simply makes no sense.
Most of the rest of the House agreed with Levine and voted 407-5 to ban all Iranian imports. A similar bill has been passed by the Senate. Whether or not the War Powers Act should be invoked in the Persian Gulf wasn't the only problem analyzed anew in the Capitol this week. Wednesday, President Reagan spoke to the Organization of American States. He said the current Central American peace plan is a good beginning, but does not address all of the American concerns, such as Cuban and Soviet advisors in Nicaragua. Mr. Reagan also renewed his support for the Nicaraguan Contras in fairly strong terms.
I make a solemn vow. As long as there is breath in this body, I will speak and work, strive and struggle for the cause of the Nicaraguan freedom fighters.
And the president said he was ready to back up his words.
I will request and fight for a $270 million package of renewed military and humanitarian assistance for the freedom fighters that will be spread over an 18-month period.
The idea, according to the president, is for the new money to tide the Contras over until the Sandinistas, negotiating with the rebels, conclude an agreement for a ceasefire and establish a democracy. However, publicly at least, the Nicaraguan government says it wants to negotiate with the United States and has no intention whatsoever of bargaining with the rebels. As for congressional approval of new money for the Contras, House Speaker Jim Wright put it this way.
I really don't believe there's any disposition in Congress to pass military money at the time when we're negotiating for peace.
Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega got his chance Thursday before the United Nations. We hear his words through a translator.
Let President Reagan recall that Rambo exists only in the movies.
The American delegation didn't get to hear that part of Ortega's speech. They had walked out after Ortega accused the United States of starting a civil war in Nicaragua. U.S. U.N. Ambassador Vernon Walters later explained the move to reporters.
We are a peace-loving country, but we have our pride. And I refuse to sit there and listen to this falsehood and nonsense any longer.
The backdrop for this most recent round of Central American maneuvering is the so-called Arias peace plan. The plan calls for a regional ceasefire to be in place by November 7th with a goal toward eventual democratic elections. It was a bad week on Wall Street. The total Dow loss for the week stands at more than 158 points, the biggest weekly drop ever. In percentage terms, the loss comes to about 6% of the Dow's value. Some analysts lay the blame at the feet of a continuing correction phase. Others say the real problem is creeping interest rates. Mary Farrell is a vice president at Payne Webber.
Interest rates is what really presents the problem for the stock market, and the higher they go, the more attractive an alternative bonds represent to stocks.
We got some hard evidence of higher interest rates Wednesday when most of the country's big banks raised their prime rate to 9.25%, an increase of 0.5%. Erwin Kellner is the chief economist at Manufacturers Hanover.
It means that money costs for businesses as well as for consumers are likely to go up.
And Kellner thinks the prime still has a way to go.
I wouldn't be surprised to see the prime rate hit 10% by the end of the year. And that's because the economy is improving and inflation is also bubbling up. And both of those lead to higher interest rates.
General Motors and the United Auto Workers reached a tentative three-year agreement this week. Details of the proposal are sketchy, but UAW President Owen Bieber says it does achieve job security for the GM membership as well as a pay raise. The UAW Executive Council will vote on the pact Monday, the membership sometime after that. Unfortunately, things aren't going quite so swimmingly for the NFL Players Association and their talks with the team owners. The two sides are talking again, and sources say these talks are substantive. The players seem to have put free agency on the back burner, at least for the time being, but a contract remains elusive. Doug Allen speaks for the Players Association.
There's no way that anybody can say, given what's happened at the bargaining table, that this agreement will be held up by the union's position on free agency. If anything holds it up, it will be management's position on this new demand for a six-year agreement.
It's official. The Reverend Jesse Jackson is now an announced candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. He took the plunge Saturday in Raleigh, North Carolina, one of the states he hopes to win in the Super Tuesday primary. ABC's John Bascom was there.
The drums of a high school band are reverberating off the high walls of the Raleigh Civic Center, where 3,000 to 4,000 Jesse Jackson supporters, part of the Rainbow Coalition, have come chanting, jabbing the air with their fists, shouting, "Win, Jesse, win," as their man, who now leads the Democratic pack for the Democratic nomination, is on stage, shaking hands and preparing to announce that his hat is, yes, indeed, in the ring. John Bascom, ABC News, with Jesse Jackson in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Jackson, the only Democrat left in the race for the nomination who's run before, is now his party's front runner. He did, however, have a few awkward moments this week. Thursday, Jackson found himself in Los Angeles explaining why he was appearing in a series of ads for a chain of business schools.
We've been offered a chance to do many kinds of commercials selling food and soft drink and product. We've never accepted in this instance because I am so committed to motivating youth to discourage them from drugs and to lift their self-esteem. We thought the request would be consistent with our life's work.
According to his spokesman, Jackson is now negotiating an end to the contract. The former Reverend Pat Robertson, now Mr. Pat Robertson, also had a few questions to answer this week in light of his quest for the top spot on next year's GOP ticket. According to published reports that have been confirmed by Robertson himself, his list of educational credits doesn't quite reflect his actual accomplishments, and his official biography misrepresents his wedding date, apparently to conceal the fact that his son was conceived out of wedlock. Even while acknowledging their validity, Robertson labeled the reports outrageous and said they overstepped the bounds of propriety. But Robertson also said they would not force him out of the race.
I have never, ever in my life indicated that the early part of my life I didn't sow some wild oats. I sowed plenty of them.
And Robertson said the revelations might actually help his campaign by showing he's only human. Mother Nature is causing continuing problems for Californians in the Los Angeles area, this time in the form of aftershocks from the big quake. The worst of the lot hit early last Sunday morning. ABC's Jane Platt lives in the City of Angels.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back to sleep, along comes another early morning aftershock. This one, a 5.5 that hit just before 4 a.m. It was centered right near Thursday's shaker, some 9 miles northeast of downtown L.A. At least one death is being blamed on the quake. An elderly woman had a heart attack.
On the East Coast, it was snow creating the waves. The earliest snowfall on record in many parts of the Northeast, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, some areas got more than a foot. More than 340,000 homes were without power. Michael Cahill is a spokesman for Niagara Mohawk Power Company in Albany. Albany was hit with 6 inches.
We could be talking several days for many of them because of the massive amount of work that is involved in getting it back. We had practically the whole system come down in some areas.
Claire Booth Luce died Friday at her home in Washington. A sort of Renaissance woman, Mrs. Luce had a varied career that encompassed the editorship of the original Vanity Fair magazine and the authorship of several hit Broadway plays. She was also a two-term congresswoman and served as ambassador to Italy in the Eisenhower administration. Her second husband was Henry R. Luce, founder of the Time Life publishing empire, and Mrs. Luce is often credited with the idea for Life magazine. She was 84. Eleanor M. Johnson, founder of My Weekly Reader, the current events magazine for school children, died Thursday. Johnson, who had remained actively involved in the Weekly Reader until 1978, was 94. The governor of Florida corrected a mistake this week. He signed a bill closing the loophole in the state's new gun law. The loophole, which allowed pretty much anyone to carry a gun strapped to his belt. Ron Johnson is a member of the Florida State House of Representatives.
We have acted responsibly here. We've clarified the law, and I think we've taken a step forward and sent a message across the country that the law is as we had thought that it was in the beginning. And I think Florida is a safe place for individuals to live and an excellent place for people to visit.
Johnson was a sponsor of the original bill. The Department of Education has come out with its long-awaited pamphlet on AIDS. It's called AIDS and the Education of Our Children. Herb Kaplow has details.
A central point is that children should be told that AIDS can be prevented by not using drugs and by restraining sexual activity. Emphasize abstinence, restraint, and responsibility, says the pamphlet. It's estimated that by age 17, almost half of all boys and about a quarter of all girls have been sexually active. The guidebook makes the point that condoms provide some but not complete protection. It also says there have been no cases reported yet of AIDS being transmitted in schools, and adds that in most cases, children with AIDS should be permitted to attend school. Possible exceptions: AIDS children who cannot control bodily functions, have open wounds or cuts, or display such behavior as biting. Herbert Kaplow, ABC News, Washington.
Critics note that the booklet seems to be in conflict with the Surgeon General's recommendation that condoms be considered a frontline defense against AIDS. Administration critics also note this week's resignations of the two top members of the President's Commission on AIDS as confirmation that the commission is in total disarray. Little Cecilia Sheehan got out of the hospital this week, the sole survivor of the recent crash of Northwest Flight 255 in Detroit. Among the more than 150 people who died in the crash were Cecilia's parents and brother. Catherine Kirtan is the information officer at the University of Michigan Medical Center.
She strikes me as a normal four-year-old. She has a wry sense of humor, and she's engaging, and she's always interested in what you're doing, and she's interested in having you pay attention to what she's doing.
Cecilia is now in her new home with her godparents in Birmingham, Alabama. We'll have one final story when World News This Week continues in a moment.
We live in a world of numbers, statistics.
More than 1 million vehicles were stolen this year. One out of every 160 registered vehicles are stolen. A vehicle theft occurs every 29 seconds.
Do those numbers mean anything to you? You may think, wow, that's a lot of stolen cars, and then move on to something else. But stop for a moment. Try to think how you'd feel if your car was stolen, just disappeared while you were in the office or out shopping or at the movies. It'd make you hopping mad.
Oh, Rex, the car is gone.
I can't believe it. I was only in the store 5 minutes and some crook ripped off my car. If I get my hands on him, old brother,
the statistic you really care about is number one, your car. Protect it from thieves. Close the windows. Lock the doors. Take your keys. Don't let your car join the list.
Police officials say more than 1 million vehicles were stolen this year.
A public service from the National Automobile Theft Bureau and the Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association.
It was 30 years ago this week that the Soviet Union shocked the United States into space with the launch of Sputnik. Though the satellite was just barely the size of a basketball, it was the catalyst for the U.S.-Soviet space race that continues to this day. Most analysts agree that the U.S. space program is going through some very tough times right now. But don't let it be said the Russians don't have problems, too. ABC's Eleanor Pelton explains.
Radio Moscow says a monkey on Cosmos 1887 has managed to free its left arm from its restraint, and the overjoyed creature is busy touching everything it can reach. His playful but potentially dangerous antics may force the satellite back to Earth. His companions, one other monkey, 10 rats, and dozens of fish, are apparently all behaving themselves, but their flight to test the effects of weightlessness, a Soviet-U.S. project resulting from a renewed treaty last spring, may come to an abrupt halt. Eleanor Pelton, ABC News, Moscow.
And those are the people and stories that made world news this week. World News This Week was written and produced by Stephanie Martz. Engineering by Tom Kennedy and Clark Granger. I'm John Grimes, ABC News, New York.